Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
How are you now? I'm joined by a couple of idiots broadcasting from the studios of Sydney in Gadigal country. It's the Theory of Thing Investment Podcast, Season 8, Episode 7. Remember, if it's talked about enough, it's a thing. This show is brought to you by the Australian Mutual Funds Exchange, giving you all the best access to all the best mutual funds around the world, anywhere you want. A reminder that all the advice contained in this is general in nature. Please speak to an advisor about your needs. Speaking of which, I am James Whelan, Investment Manager at VFS Group. I'm a white male, age 41. I'm wearing a grey suit, white shirt, blue tie. I'm joined by monkey number one, Heath Moss of HLM Investment. How are you now, Heath?
I'm very well, thanks, mate. Hope you're well as well.
This, mate, you know what? Actually, a quick announcement to make. I've been up since Sparrows, absolutely thumping through the day. I've had an Alan Gray presentation for lunch. Fantastic. They're always doing good work.
How good are they?
I know that they're amazing. Keep doing good work. I've managed to really help out a client extraordinarily well with some stuff with her allocations and get her out of a bit of strife. This is that one that I was sort of talking about last week. So it's the way that retail works, it's never just easy. It's never just one thing. It's always just a continual alteration, gray area, getting through and doing everything that you can to help someone out. So I'm making an official declaration, an announcement. That is how that is going. It's not 8 o'clock in the morning, guys. It's 3:21 in the afternoon on the 25th of May, 2023 in Sydney. So I'm allowed to have a beer, and that's it. I'm also joined by Chris Weston of Pepperstone. Chris, how are you now?
Mate, I'm good. Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure for being on today.
Oh, get a beer in your hand. That's an Orion. That's an Orion draft. They saw that downstairs. I'm at the Castle Ray office today, so that goes all right, mate. Now, we've had a bit going on, to putting it lightly, I suppose. I think I'm gonna go out on a limb here, and you know, hey, it's a big world. We're all men here. I'm gonna say that I probably underplayed the deal in the debt ceiling situation. I think that I underplayed. Not only did I underplay, I assumed that a deal was going to get done fairly rapidly, or at least on the deadline that it can get done. And then I was thinking, okay, then it's done and then everything sort of moves on. I was not as aware as I should have been, and this is something that I want to amend because, you know, the wisest of men still have much to learn, as they say.
Yeah.
That it was sort of more of an it was actually a Morgan Stanley note that came out at the top of the week, just sort of talking about that potentially we see that the next downturn in the market is that even if a deal does get passed, in the US. And I'm talking about the debt ceiling thing. I don't need to explain this. And if you don't know what the debt ceiling is, then maybe this isn't the podcast for you, or look it up as we sort of go along. But that as a deal sort of got passed, that amount of money that was then going to be agreed on whatever deal that had to happen to raise the debt ceiling was actually then going to be a negative for markets. And they said that, and they didn't really go into the detail of doing it. Now, I know that, Chris, it's not your wheelhouse. That's okay. But I've had you on because you have been banging the drum, to your credit, about how important this debt ceiling thing was. We have been listening to you. We have not been ignoring you. We have been listening to you. But you put out a first-class, phenomenal YouTube video last week.
Yesterday.
I was thinking,
that's how well James is going.
I've had three sips of this Orion beer, and I'm good. I'm good to go, mate. You put out this a cracking YouTube video, which I'm assuming is linked to your Twitter account or wherever you want to put it. The details exactly what's going on. It's it's first class. Can you please try and help me understand the lose-lose downside of the situation? And mainly what they talked about is that we see that this is a liquidity crisis, that even if a deal gets passed, how liquidity gets taken out of the market. I know it's not your wheelhouse, but if you could just kindly explain what is going on.
Yeah, look, I think there's not that many people in the public domain who are experts in the financial plumbing. There are a lot of people in the podcast scene who are, you know, who made a made a bit of a trait for themselves as being the experts in this world.
Steady on, pal.
My scene is as a trader and also in Heath's world and your world is as an investor is how we can recognize certain things to manage risk, right? So what we're looking for is what are the risks around this? And I think it comes back to the first point. So as soon as a deal's passed and it's voted through Congress, the Treasury Department have a mandate now to fund itself so they can make ongoing payments. You know, these are the things that they've been restrained from doing so because their cash balance has been drawn down. And, of course, the debt ceiling has been, fixed. So the first thing they're going to do is go out and fund themselves. And they'll do that through the capital markets and they'll issue bills. And so for people out there who don't know what treasury bills are, they are effectively short-term debt instruments. They don't pay a coupon or a level of fixed income, fixed interest. They are issued at a discount. So, say 98 cents on the dollar or whatever they're trading at, 99.8 cents on the dollar. Mm-hmm. And they will redeem on maturity at a par 100. These are the most sought after high quality instruments in the financial markets. They're used for collateral purposes in repo and for so many different parts. But ultimately, the Treasury Department will go out and say, we're going to issue $1.4 trillion worth of debt over a 12-month period, which is an obscene amount of money. But what they'll also do is front load that. So we're talking about $750 to $800 billion of these short-term bills, which are going to be issued to the markets. There'll be a private buyers. There'll be people who are there who are supporting these. So, go back to your world, which is an equity market. Mm-hmm. This is like a company going out and saying, we want to raise cash, and they'll issue more shares. The market then absorbs that and buys that on the IPO, for example. So these guys, they'll issue these T-bills, $700 billion in we're talking about a couple of months' time. Which is a ridiculous amount of money that needs to be absorbed by the private markets. So it comes down to who's buying this. Well, first of all, you've got money market funds. These are government agencies, government funds, who largely invest their capital in what we call the RRP facility, which is the reverse repo facility. They get sort of a risk-free rate of 5.05%. So this is where it comes to the plumbing, right? They control short-term interest rates, what we call the Fed funds effective rate, things like SOFR rates, GC repo, all these kind of short-term rates. They use that by controlling it with an upper and lower corridor. This is where it gets very technical. But ultimately, money market funds could absorb this very easily. They've got over $4 trillion of capital. That means obviously liquidating some of these RRP holdings. Where it becomes very interesting are banks, who we all know that in the US, well, a lot of people know that in the US that if someone deposits $1 million with a bank, they have to hold reserves against that deposit, 10%. Yep. So
capital adequacy.
Exactly right. So yep. if someone deposits $1 million with a bank, they need to hold $100,000 as a reserve.
Yep.
And they have a minimum amount of reserves that need to be in the system. Anything above those regulatory requirements, interest, they will park that money on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet and they will earn 5.15%. This is interest earned on excess reserves, okay? What we're seeing is that some of these private entities will look to draw down on these excess reserves. There's currently $3.28 trillion of these excess reserves in the system. And what they'll do is they'll liquidate these excess reserves and use those dollars then to support the treasury market and the treasury issuance that we're talking about, $800 billion. The concern we've got in the market here, where it becomes a bit of a risk event, is there is a flaw where there is too few reserves in the market. They have to have a certain amount because of regulatory demands. But if it goes down to a certain level, then shit breaks. We saw that in 2019 when we saw the repo crisis. We saw a level of reserves coming to a scarcity. Effectively, then we saw repo blowing up. We saw repo rates. Now, repo, for people out there who don't understand it, effectively, I will use a treasury bond or a T-bill, and I will use that as collateral to get short-term overnight collateral as loan funding. And I will get that cash and I'll be using that for my working capital as a business. Banks use it all the time. It's really, really important. One of the most important parts of the financial system. So treasury bills are really important in that capacity for financing.
Before COVID, repo almost fell over. And everyone forgot about that because COVID took the headline.
Well, that was 2019, so you can go and Wikipedia it and look it up. And so the point was is reserves in the system got down to a finite level. Remember, there is a fixed level where there's a scarcity, and that level is around $2.3-2.5 trillion.
Okay.
So if we were to see, which is the consensus of the market, if we were to see about $500 billion of reserves being drawn down to buy these bills from these households and banks entities, then we get to a level where we start seeing a very thin buffer between what is considered to be a minimum capital level of reserves and some problematic situations. So that's the concern that we have, is that the level of issuance that's going to be happened by the Treasury to rebuild their very, very low cash levels that they've got at the moment, so they can make these ongoing payments to things like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, obviously it's bond obligations, maturing T-bills, all these factors that they need the cash for. They issue these bills, and what it's going to do is it's going to suck liquidity out of the market, and it's going to get these levels of reserves down to a minimum level of reserves. That's when things start to become a little bit problematic. So that's what we're seeing. We're going to see QT effectively on steroids. Now, of course, the fact that we know about this is kind of like this big known unknown. But at the same time, I think, the Treasury has to do this. They have to rebuild their cash levels. They've already told us they're going to be raising $1.3-1.4 trillion. The question is how do the markets react once this has happened? That's what we're, I think this is where the conversation is now.
Yep.
It's not necessarily about the debt ceiling. We all know there has to be a reconciliation. We know there has to be a solution that goes through. By its general nature, there has to be an agreement, otherwise there'll be a catastrophe going on. The debt ceiling will be raised. The conversation now is once it's raised, once they issue this amount of debt and you're sucking dollars out the system, you're going to see short-term rates going up, dollar liquidity going up. What does this mean for the financial markets?
Can you explain in really simple terms what that means on the economy side of things, for earnings side of things, all this liquidity being sucked out of the system?
It's a good question. I think, first of all, let's take it a step back. The agreement that takes place between the Democrats and the Republicans, that could have a big implication for economics in itself, right? I mean, the Republicans want spending caps, spending cuts. The Democrats want tax hikes. Let's say we get spending cuts. It's a question of what those spending cuts look like in the first place. I mean, are we talking 50 basis points off GDP over the next 12 months plus? I mean, that's coming in when we get a slightly slowing economy as it is. So I think that agreement is one thing that we need to consider before we even think about QT. We go into the situation where liquidity is being sucked out. Look, you've got all these reserves coming down to a level of scarcity. At the moment, we've got ample reserves in the system. If we get down to a level of scarcity, then I think that has big implications for risk assets, because liquidity effectively is the oxygen in the market's lungs. That's the way we've got to think about it.
Mm.
If there's too few reserves in the system, that's when the cost of dollar funding goes up, short-term rates go up. Effectively, what you're doing then is the cost of capital is going up for businesses. It's going up for everyone in the market. So the cost for repo is going up. The cost for leverage for repo is going up. If you're a business out there and you want a short-term loan, effectively what you're seeing is the short-term money market rates, where the cost for interbank liquidity is going up. That cost of funding is going up, and that makes borrowing more expensive. That means credit contracts, banks, deposits flee. And so that's very hard to model. But what it also ultimately means is that you're going to see lower loan growth. The cost for borrowing is going to go up. And so it's going to have obviously a negative impact on economics. So it's difficult to say, for me to say this is what it's going to do, because that really depends on what happens with short-term rates. We're talking about GC repo rates. We're talking about SOFR rates and various factors. But what I'm looking for most importantly, and this is kind of where we get really technical, is where the market tells me that they're seeing stress in the financial system. So I can talk about all these acronyms. I can talk about these kind of crazy interbank rates and stuff like this that most people haven't heard of.
Hmm.
What's most important for me is when the market tells me we're at a point of stress. Now, that might not happen. The fact this is so well telegraphed suggests that all these authorities may get their house in order and actually look to limit this damage. But what we're looking at is everyone can go out and Google it, and it's called the Fed Funds Effective Rate. Okay, so this is where they guide the cost of money. This is the cost of money and cost of interbank borrowing. So these are the weighted average of daily transactions that take place between repo, between SOFR, all this kind of these short-term rates. Now, if we see that trading at a premium to the upper bounds, which is called the interest earned on reserve balances, IORB, which you can see on TradingView. If that trades at a premium, then basically it's telling me that monetary policy is broken in the US. And if it gets to above 10 basis points, this is the point, I believe, that the Federal Reserve are going to turn around and they're going to stop quantitative tightening, which effectively is allowing their balance sheet to run off and contract. So all these bonds that become to maturity, they won't reinvest the proceeds. They'll just allow their balance sheet to run off. That's the trigger point. So you'll see the effective rate, the cost of these short-term loans trading above the upper band that the Fed set. That's the point when we're going to see real stress. That's the point where the market will be saying that we're going to see an end to QT, and perhaps we could see a short burst of quantitative easing, balance sheet expansion, printing reserves, just like the Bank of England did. Do you remember when we had the that short-term burst where the pension funds. Well, the gilt market blew up, and they had to come in and do a short burst of QE effectively to help the pension industry effectively. So we could see that. So this is going to be the big trade. Effectively, what you're doing is you're sucking liquidity out of the market. You're raising dollar rates. You're raising dollar funding, and you could get to a point where there's going to be stress in the cost for finance.
Okay. That is, I think, probably the best explanation that I could possibly put together. Or that I could have on here.
It's one of those things where you have to know the plumbing of the financial system. There's a lot of kind of short-term borrowing rates and things that a lot of people have ever heard of. What's most important, though, is I don't think you necessarily need to understand who the players are, who has access to RRP, who has access to the interest on excess reserve. All you need is that there's a ridiculous amount of money, of bills that are going to be issued to the private sector. That needs to be absorbed. And when you're talking about that level of capital that needs to be absorbed, of course, that's coming out of another part of the market. So you're sucking liquidity out of one part of the market that could be used in other places. And I think that's going to have a dramatic effect. It could have a dramatic effect on funding in the markets.
Yeah, and that is fairly where the prediction lies at the moment on that one too. So that does explain it quite well. About it's just basically just where funds are better used. Okay, use it in this particular area as opposed to
Going to European banks as well. You know, the European banks borrowed a whole heap of money from the ECB after the pandemic. They were called the PEP program, so the pandemic emergency program. Mm. And they borrowed, I can't remember the exact number, but it's talking billions and billions of dollars, euros of very, very, very cheap liquidity. And they could use that for whatever reason they wanted, for borrowing purposes and try and grow their earnings effectively. But they got very cheap liquidity. Now, they've paid a lot of this money back to the ECB, but we're still talking about something like 530 billion euros of these loans, which are expected to be paid back to the ECB on the 30th of June. That's a lot of liquidity coming off the European bank's balance sheet that needs to be paid back. And again, I don't think that's fully priced into markets as well. So that could have an impact on the cost of banks' funding. And so we may see some greater fragility coming through in the European banks as a result of all this liquidity coming off the European bank's balance sheet and going back to the ECB. So we're talking in that Q3 window, a liquidity drain from markets. And as I said, liquidity is the life in financial markets. We've all become accustomed to it. There's a difference between system liquidity, which is, the level of reserves and level of cash in the financial system. And then there's obviously what you and I deal with every day. It's just liquidity in the market, which allows us to get in and out of positions and plays into our transaction costs. But liquidity in financial markets, whether it's system liquidity or market liquidity, is probably one of the most important functions in financial markets.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Excellent. Chris, I know that you've got a hard stop, mate. You got a footy tip for us?
I can't get into my sports bet account to give you the tip, I'm afraid. So I might have to come back to you on Twitter on that one.
All right, mate.
Odds
on
odds on Arsenal winning the title next year.
Piss off.
Or bottling it. Which one?
Mate, if we'd had this podcast this time last year and you said Arsenal were going to come second, I would have bitten your arm off every day of the week. We're going to be Champions League football. And do you know, as Ray Parlour quite eloquently said, it doesn't matter where we finish. Tottenham are far worse than us.
I actually think that Tottenham have missed out on that beautiful, the coveted fifth, that Europa League group stage as well, which is something that, yeah, everyone really guns for that. That's the dream, getting in there. I actually think they've missed that too. It's all gone cactus. I think this weekend we've actually got, this is the big relegation weekend, isn't it?
Teams that could drop out. We'll move around. The points are really tight down the bottom there. So, yeah, it could be a bit of action. But my Liverpool got that fifth spot in what was a very disappointing season by our standards.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's possible, mate, Tottenham might have been Tottenham should have been a bit higher. Arsenal should have won the whole thing. Manchester City are cheats. Liverpool underperformed. And there's the year in review from the EPL show, a.k.a. the theory of things. Chris Weston, no one disagrees. When I say Manchester City are a bunch of cheats, I mean, come on, guys. Come on.
115 charges against them.
Come on.
They got to sort it out.
Yeah, they're up for the triple. It's not great, to be honest. But, I mean, at least English football's dominating, and so it's better than Italian football dominating, I suppose.
You've got a weird way of rationalising stuff, mate. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I don't know. You've got me on talking about the debt ceiling and the aftermarket, and it's, I hope I did it. It's a hard subject as simple as possible, but
you've done a great job.
Sports the what everyone tunes in for, right?
Yeah,
exactly,
mate. And that was a really good way of just explaining exactly what's ahead, and it is still ahead. I don't believe it's priced into markets.
I don't think it's priced at all, to be honest.
Yeah,
and
me either.
You know, binary situations are difficult to price,
and this is going to be one of those things that in about 2 months' time, or maybe in 6 weeks' time, I personally believe everyone's going to be talking about this. And I think this is kind of like, at the moment, it's kind of the last 2 weeks, it's been rate strategists at JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, as you say, who have been sort of talking about this and what life looks like with this massive amount of issuance and this QT on steroids effectively. And in 2 weeks, you're going to see the mainstream media talking about it. And when markets start reacting, which I think they will, then it will be a mainstream conversation. So, yeah, I mean, it's good to do your homework. It's good to understand why this is happening, even if you don't fully understand the mechanics of it, so you can manage that risk a little bit better.
Good enough for me, mate. Well done.
Excellent. Thanks, mate.
Take care, lads. Thank you all.
Yeah.
Well, that was Chris Weston from Pepperstone. And as always, a good friend of the show, has been ever since we were named something different, has been a friend of the show ever since it wasn't technically my show, but it was my idea when it was back called, what was it called? Devils and Details with Business Insider.
That's going back a bit.
That is going back a long way. That's when Colgo and I had a beer and I was just like, you know what? I want to do a podcast. And Colgo's like, I need to leave. I'm going to go and start a podcast. So I was like, thanks. Anyway, and that's where all that came from. What have we got? So who's?
I think just touching on that debt ceiling stuff again.
Yep.
I think what Westy has got right is the mainstream media and even mainstream financial markets media are really covering this agreement hard and going hard on the agreement. It is really hard to find anything out there on the aftermath, what happens next. And that's why I think Chris Weston's video on YouTube, which I think we should put in the show notes if we can.
Yeah, I'll check it out.
Is so important. It does really well to break it down of the consequences of this agreement and, you know, what can happen in money markets moving forward. And I think things like he talks about in there about a shortage of US dollars and that's possibly why the US dollar is already rallying now. That is in preparation for this. And obviously that has flow-on effects like, it's negative for gold, it's negative for commodities overall, headwinds for earnings moving forward, et cetera, et cetera. So I implore everyone to go have a look at that YouTube video and have a listen.
Yeah, I'll chuck it in the notes. Actually, I'm going to try and find it now as we sort of have this discussion as we go and see if I can pull it up because it was sensational.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Now, because we had Chris on a hard stop, so we sort of skipped out in the beginning. Heath, how are you going? You well?
I'm fantastic.
What's the latest from your neckers, mate?
A bit stressed. We're organising a birthday party for my seven-year-old. He turned seven on Monday, but he's having his first ever birthday party on Saturday with a few mates and that, just at a local park and that. But the amount of stress of getting everything done and, you know, making sure everything's ready is just keeping another eye on the weather as well. It's just, stressing myself and my wife out a little bit.
Yeah. May child.
He's pumped for it. He's pumped for it. So,
what sort of cake?
Chocolate mud cake, just traditional chocolate mud cake.
Yeah. Because, seven-year-old boys are amazing when it comes to chocolate mud cake and keeping their stuff clean, mate. Are you sure that's a low? Let's talk about low percentage trades here, mate. Come on.
Wear a dark shirt. It's a How to Train Your Dragon theme. So there's a lot of black in that. So that's good. You won't see any brown stains or
all right, bunch of goth kids in the park. in Adelaide too, which is the home of Australian goth. Fantastic, mate. I am looking
stories I could tell you.
the weather's starting to turn a touch, isn't it? I've got my Castlereagh office where I'm working out of here in town. I used to have water views that I look over Sydney Harbour, a little bit of Sydney Harbour, tiny amounts, and now they've put a building up in front of me, which shows that things are going amazing. I'll do my Craig Jones. As you can see, based on the amount of buildings that are going up around Sydney, construction is going booming. So there's no reason at all to stay away from the construction companies in Sydney. So that's actually a big reason to stay away from the construction. Anyway. So commercial property is absolutely going fantastically well. And the reflection that I've got shows that there's a bit of nasty weather out there in Sydney at the moment, so it's interesting. Myself, not that you asked, I'm sore as hell, mate. I'm absolutely sore. I'm training my ass off. Yeah.
Rope jump.
I'm jump roping because I'm in for the 3 minute and the 30 second speed at Nationals, which starts in 2 weeks and 1 day.
There is a joke there I'm not going to touch.
What's that?
The 3 minute or the 30 second.
Classy, super classy. So that's what I've got ahead of me, and I've been doing it. It's skipping on tiles. Like my glutes are in pain. Another joke. But my back is absolutely killing me. There's a reason why gymnasts and these guys do that stuff on that beautiful sprung floor that they have at the centers. So I'm really feeling it. Also, my posture is just generally speaking pretty ordinary anyway. So that's how that's going. Oh, that's hell's bells. Now, although the markets, here's the thing, everyone getting very freaked out about markets. Now, back to actual work stuff that we're talking about here. And I'm just going to pull up two of the things that I've got that I really wanted to talk to you about. Where are we here? Okay, so markets are absolutely, people have started to panic. What's going on with the markets? But, quite frankly, I had a look at our US exposure, which you should do, and you're supposed to know this, but I actually you got to have a double check and just sort of see what your US exposure. Our two biggest US holdings that we have in our portfolios are HNDQ, because I always go hedge because I hate having to play the currency game. I'm just not good at it. And QHAL, so the quality ETF and the NASDAQ ETF.
Yep.
And the third and fourth, I don't know in which order, biggest holding in each one of those ETFs is NVIDIA. So
yep.
Based on last night, our US exposure is fine. Do you want to walk us through the NVIDIA bits and pieces?
That was phenomenal this morning. Seeing a $700 billion plus company pop 26% in after hours, that is phenomenal. It's going to be knocking on the door of the $1 trillion club soon.
It could be tonight.
Yeah, it could be. But, I mean, to me, I mean, because we know what's coming up in that third quarter with that liquidity drain, et cetera, and how equity markets have reacted to that in the past, as in quick, short, sharp sell-offs, like 10% plus sell-offs, I think it could be an opportunity to take some of that money off the table, especially in HNDQ. But that result from NVIDIA was really, really solid. They smashed earnings and revenue guidance, estimates out of the park, even though they're still down. I think earnings were down 20% and revenue down 13% this period last year. But it was their forecast that really, really got everyone excited, their Q2 forecast. I think the market expected $7 billion in revenue for Q2. They came out and said, we're expecting 11, so, you know, 60% higher.
Yep.
Then they made mention, I was going through some of their notes, made mention that they expect second half to be super, super strong, much, much more stronger than the first half this year.
Yep.
It's all being driven by AI and data centers. Data center revenue grew
14%. Well, how about that?
Yeah, grew 14% in Q1, and that's over 50% of their revenue.
Yep.
So that's where the growth is coming. Gaming's also a large part of their revenue, around 20%, but that was off 38%, but that's normal considering the cycle of the Xboxes and PlayStations, et cetera, out there.
Yep, yep.
But it's all about data centers and everyone moving towards this being able to offer AI services at their data centers,
yep,
and having to upgrade.
Yep.
And from what I hear, Amazon and AWS are the ones that are most furthest behind.
Microsoft, they're done with their cloud stuff. Okay.
Yeah, they're furthest behind in terms of their AI abilities and offerings. So apparently their current chipsets in their data centers aren't what you need. And they're going to spend a lot of CapEx over the next few years getting them upgraded. But Microsoft and Google are well ahead there and on the front foot. So
I've got a friend.
Yeah, it's all about AI, obviously.
It's all about AI. I've got a friend who's in tech. Any more details on that? Okay. And I was talking about my idea with Equinix. Remember I bought Equinix a few weeks ago?
Yep.
It's actually more like it was about a month or so ago. It was a bit longer than that. Just based on this data centers being you know, it's a great company, but also just based on that boost from data centers, everything like that. His response to me was just like, oh, the AI thing is a lot of it's overblown, and look, it's going to get found out that a lot of the requirements aren't, and you're going to find that a lot of the staff that get replaced by AI technically means that data centers won't actually be any won't grow as much as people say that they will based on it. And I've just gone, here's the difference between someone who's on the inside of the knowledge, but not inside information, who's on the inside of the knowledge, who's close to the knowledge, but not in investments, because we hadn't hit the exuberant phase yet. And I don't think that we had. Maybe last night was. Maybe this morning was.
Yeah, I think last night would be. And tonight, okay. I think will be a confirmation.
And I was sort of pointing out to him that investing isn't always about doing what's right. Sometimes it's more about just doing what you know the crowd is going to do.
The momentum.
That thing. I said, mate, they're going to say, yes, AI, all of these things are going to get bit up. Everything is going to go bananas. That's when you sell, and because you know that a lot of it is a foo-for-all. You know that data center companies, this is what he said to me. So imagine a data center company, right? So you've got Equinix, that they're running their data centers, and you've got your AI things going. This is where it's all going to get, the floor is going to come out of it. We've seen the floor come out of every single thing, the graphite and lithium and cloud stuff, and it, you know, where it's just like, okay, this is a little bit overcooked because everyone gets all excited about it and everyone jumps in. He was like, imagine a data center company. So you're a sales guy for a data center company, or you know, you're a key account manager, and you go to the Commonwealth Bank of Australia and you say to them, hey, with all this AI stuff that we've got going on, your data center charge is now at 50%.
There's
not even a conversation you're going to have, right?
No.
So you can't price that in to the data center company. And I was like, yeah, you're right. Absolutely. He's going, okay, so why are we investing in this? I said, because we know that this hasn't, that exuberance hasn't been priced in yet.
And it's got such a long tail and runway ahead.
Yeah.
There's still so much of the digital economy yet to move to the cloud and yet to, you know, even touch AI or think about touching AI.
Yeah.
So we need more data centers. We need more chips.
We definitely need more.
So the growth in earnings in that should continue for a while.
Mm.
And I think, you look at something like NVIDIA is trading 50, 60 times earnings. And you say that's just ridiculous. But I think the market's pricing, what's happening 5-10 years down the track with this sort of stuff.
Oh, mate,
and NVIDIA are the the poster boys of AI and chips in the market as well. I mean, they're probably the forefront of the technology, them and Taiwan Semiconductors.
Yeah.
And the guys like AMD and Intel are well behind. So
there's a few stocks that I just wish I bought and hold, and that's it. And that's Google, obviously.
Yep.
Which I'm still, partially holding on. And NVIDIA, you look at, and also to some extent, Amazon below $1,000, like back in 2016-17. That's the sort of thing that that you've got clients that actually go and say, "Hey, I've got this," and it's a real thing. I do want to talk more about sort of this our experience as retail advisors as well.
Clients love to hold names that people know, say I own Apple shares, own
crazy low prices too.
Yeah. I own CSL shares. That's a big one for me and my clients. I've got a lot of clients that got in the IPO of CSL back in the 90s.
Oh,
and they haven't sold a single stock. They keep adding, and they just love it to bits. And you can't argue against it at the moment.
Yeah, and you can't. And we'll get Rudy on here one time from FN Arena to talk about CSL. It's just banging the drum. All right, now next stage in the show, I'm going to throw three tweets that I've picked up here at you, Heath. Completely unplanned.
Yep.
This is the new thing that I've just decided to start last week. And okay, you ready?
Coming in fresh.
First one. Yep. Now I don't know who it's from. I think it's that Nate. What's his name? Nate Gerasi or whoever it was. It's there. Anyway, right. The first tweet. 96% of S&P 500 return contribution from the 10 largest constituents. No other positive performance year even close, except for 2007. So we've had 95.6% of the top 10 as a percentage of total.
That doesn't surprise me at all. I'd heard last week it was 78% was attributed to the top five.
Yep, I put that on his tweet. That's right. Yeah, and these are numbers that have just been thrown around. But the top ten at 95.6. Top 10 in 2007, where the S&P 500 went up 3.5%, and keep in mind that this year the S&P 500 is already up 9.2%. That in 2007, which was only up by a third of what we're up already, only 78.7% was attributed to the top 10. Nothing has even come close. And then it goes daylight, 58.9% back in 2020, 54% back in 1990. You usually sort of expect that to be sort of the area that you're in. Mate, at what stage do you go these defensive tech stocks? I hate to say they are, but you've got to rebalance a touch at some stage, right? Yeah.
I think tonight will be the night. I think we, as exuberant and everyone could be saying, the NASDAQ, I think futures are up about 1.5% or something like that. I think we could see some money taken off the tables. You could see NVIDIA open at, $380 a share from the close of 305 last night.
Yep.
And it's going to drag a lot of tech stocks with it. I think you're going to see some profit taking towards the end of the thing, especially with the nervousness about the debt ceiling agreement. And I think some of the aftermath of the debt ceiling, when it does get agreed, is starting to cycle through the markets. I think, and like you said, the rally has been so concentrated in, those 10 names. I can't see how you couldn't take some money off the table and say, let's see how this plays out. And I think, like I said, it could be, tonight.
Okay, could be. I'm just looking at now that you mention it, there's just some bits. Look, I would be looking at that right now. It's 358 on Thursday afternoon. There's no chance to close any of those ETFs if you wanted to do so. So I'm just going to sit here and talk to you and just hope that it's one more day to go until I sort of start to slice a little bit off the table on these ones. But the try not to react a bit too much. Right, the next one. Kit Lowe, who's posted something from the Bank of America Global Research team. The US, this is a bit of a chance for me to get on my soapbox and do a bit of a gloat. The US 60-40 portfolio was a disaster in 2022, as we know.
Yep.
But it is up 28% year to date.
Sensational. Yep.
Who do you know anyone who spent a fair chunk of last year saying that 60-40 was going to be one of the better ways of going about your year in 2023?
I might know someone, but I don't know his name.
Come on, man.
His head's big enough.
Come on, man. I got a little bit slammed for it. And also, it's just like a lot of people, it was fine. But the Bank of America fund manager research actually showed that people thought that it was going to be the worst performing portfolio into this year as well.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not surprised at the psychology of that sort of things. You know, the worst performing, everyone thinks it's going to roll on forever until it's not. But I'm not surprised it's done so well considering where rates were at the end of last year, yields were, and where they are now. They're still a good, 70, 80 basis points below their peaks last year. So, bond prices have obviously lifted nicely.
Okay. And the last one that I've got here has got to be from Ryan Dietrich. And you can pick anything from Ryan on Twitter. He's got some great stats about past and previous times in the market. He's always a guy who's like, well, if the first month is positive after the last 10 months have been such and such, then usually the market's in. And a lot of it's grain of salt because, the future is not always what the past is representative of, but something like this is something that you want to pay attention to maybe. Another clue, the October lows are in place and won't be violated, The S&P 500 200-day moving average is officially trending higher. Going back to the past 50 years, I see 10 other times this happened and not once were new lows made. In fact, a strong higher trend was the norm.
Yeah, I mean it's dangerous when you set those sort of precedents because it's just begging for the investment gods to throw it back in your face, isn't it?
Yeah.
Look, I mean, what's the lows around? The intraday lows were around the 3-4 mark in there, the 3.4 to 3.5, I think, on the S&P 500. Yeah, I can see a case where they don't get breached again this time around. Because, I mean, look, if you take tech out, forward earnings are around 16.5 times on the S&P 500, which isn't too bad. When you add them back in, it's over 18, so it's looking quite expensive.
Mm.
So take 10% off the market. We're heading towards, 3,700. So, I can see that. I can see that holding true. Yes.
I can also see a lot of people with eyes on severe technical areas on the S&P 500 with this thing that Chris Weston just ran us through, drawing big, thick lines. Sometimes they get a bit thicker just so you give yourself a bit of leeway. And, I reckon there's if it bounces off some of these ones, that's going to be some of the best buying you could do in 2023.
Yep. My areas were 40, 50, which I think we'll test next week.
Yep.
And 39, 20. I haven't looked below that yet. But, I can see, if we start to get that liquidity drain in Q3 like Westy was speaking about, I can see that quick 10% sell-off happening. And that's going to provide an excellent opportunity to jump into the market, I feel, especially into the resources and anything with a US dollar headwind space is going to be a prime opportunity to jump into something in those areas.
Not at all. Now, have you got anything other business related to talk about? Otherwise, we're going to switch to footy tips.
No, I think that's about it.
Well, my little bottle of Red Label here, and that should go nicely. Okay, now. It's Thursday. It's after the market, guys. Everyone, give me a break. It's been a long day, and I've had a lot of wins today. Everyone is fantastic. Everyone is happy. Amazingly, portfolios are sort of flat, upish. Actually, I haven't even checked the latest one, so everyone's fine. AFL tips, Heath. What do you got?
I went 50% last week. Well, the multi would have failed, but if you took them individually, It was 50%.
That was not what you advised, Heath Moss.
No, I didn't. I know.
Okay.
I know.
You can't say if you hadn't listened to my advice and done something completely random, you would have won money. That's not how it works, my friend. Own the loss and move on.
It's owned. It's owned.
Okay.
it's still running at about 80 or 90% win rate.
Shut up.
I think because I totally forgot that we were doing this podcast today and hadn't looked at the AFL properly this round. But I think last game of the round, Adelaide versus Brisbane. Adelaide's paying $2.15 at home. I think we can beat anyone at Adelaide Oval. Yep. And I think that's good money. At $2.15, I will take the Crows at home versus Brisbane.
Good work, mate. Okay, Crows at home versus the Brisbane Bears at Adelaide Oval. Good work. You know what I've got here, and you know how much I love my my North Sydney Bears that aren't in the NRL, which we can talk about that at a later time. What have I got down here? Now, I do hate the Manlys, and hello to Shore and Partners, and I look forward to the next time that I get invited out to the Manly Sea Eagles. We've got money with you. The Newcastle Knights are playing the Manly Sea Eagles. I'm going to take the Newcastle Knights to beat the spread.
What's the spread?
I think it's 5.5. What have you got on your screen? 10.5. Whoa.
Jeez, hang on a minute, mate. What's going on?
Mate, I'm looking at something else here. I tell you, I reckon the Newcastle Knights will win by 6. Okay, so if you want to do the skinny one, they'll win head to head $1.35. I think that if you pick your own margin, they'll win by 6, probably 10. So take 6 and give yourself a buffer. And what else have I got going on here? There was another one that I looked and just went, yeah, that sounds about right too. Parramatta Eels. They'll win. And they'll win, and they'll win convincingly well too. 14.5.
Yeah.
You know what? Slice that down. I always hate taking the bookie starts. You know what? Actually, I'm going to say this too. I hate taking the bookie start. I like to skim it down to about $1.60. So pick your own margin, take it down to $1.60, and then just settle wherever that is that's there, because the bookie's been really, really good at getting starts very, very close. As the Anzac Day Collingwood-Essendon game proved, it being right on the half-point mark on the siren. How do you think I was on that particular bet?
on the other side.
The bookies have been really good. Whatever algo they've got running now has just tuned in perfectly, and good on it, whatever it's doing. AI will destroy us all. So that's what I've got. Parramatta Eels, take them, you know, whatever gets you $1.60, and the Newcastle Knights also sort of take 6 points. They'll win that game by about 6 or more. So AI, last minute AI chat, and then we'll close it off.
We welcome our new AI overlords.
So always make sure that you thank your AI machine.
Thank you, Siri, Amazon,
maybe
Google.
Always thank Siri, the last one. This episode is brought to you by the Australian Mutual Funds Exchange. Go to amfex.com on your desktop to go and check out what they can do and get long pretty much any mutual fund on the planet. And it's an amazing way of sort of getting to know it. We didn't even touch on Priority and his cavalcade of cavalcades being through the city over the last couple of days. They came through Milsons Point, and that was very exciting for us. But Australian-Indian relationships never been stronger, and there's some amazing Indian funds that are out there. Oh, there was one other thing that I'm talking about this week, which is that the decoupling from China has given this amazing boost to India and Japanese funds as well. That really needs to be paid attention to. One of the most important sentences, I read out one of the most important sentences, which is exactly that. Market flow has to go somewhere, and it will, and also economic flow has to go somewhere, and it will go to Japan, and it will absolutely go to India. Japan, if you want the developed market that will do your stuff that's premium stuff, and India, if you want your developing market that will do it cheap and do their absolute best to get it done. And those are the two best emerging markets you can imagine over the next couple of months. So there you go.
Beautiful.
Okay. Are we done?
Yeah, I think we're done.
Thanks for joining us, everyone, and I'll see you next time. Cheers, Heath.
Have a good one. See ya.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.